Flying Fortresses, the pioneer four-motored bomber in the air since 1935. Steamroller construction, weight about 25 tons, speed better than 300 miles an hour.
It is hard to pick the Boeing Company's most famous plane, but any short list would certainly include the B-17 Flying Fortress. This week marks an anniversary of a fateful and mostly forgotten flight back in 1935 that almost scuttled not only the plane, but the entire company. Here is historian Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, it's one of the most iconic bombers from World War II, key part of Allied strategy to fight the Nazis and liberate Europe. Before that, though, what eventually became the B-17 suffered a tragic setback not many people remember. You know, as we've seen in Indonesia this week, flying still has inherent risks, right? Anyhow, Boeing's roots as a local company go back to 1916, but the B-17 story begins in 1934 when the company was broken up by the Roosevelt administration. They'd been building airplanes, flying A-mail.
United was part of Boeing at one point.
Yeah, exactly. They were forced to spin off several companies, United Technologies and what became United Airlines. Bill Boeing eventually sort of left the company, kind of a bitter, defeated man, and a guy named Claire Ekvet was in charge in September of 1934 and decided to focus on building big airplanes, kind of like what they do today. Around the same time, the U.S. Army Air Corps asked for prototypes for a multi-engine coastal defense plane. They weren't thinking about strategic bombing yet. They're just thinking about protecting the coast from invaders. And, oh, one catch, there's no money from the government to build the prototype. You got to do it yourself. So Ekvet says, let's bet the whole company. Let's spend every little bit of available cash, and we'll design and build what's called the Model 299. It's a big, shiny, aluminum, four-engine bomber bristling with machine guns. It debuts at Boeing Field on a Sunday in July of 1935. It's a big hit. It's huge. Gets a ton of media attention. And as we've seen with even more recent Boeing rollouts, it generates a lot of excitement. Mike Lombardi's a Boeing corporate historian. I spoke with him earlier this month at his office at the Boeing Archives. Boy, what a cool office that is. You see all the stuff stacked around the models of planes and stuff? Anyway, he told me how the Model 299 came to be known by its more famous nickname.
It had four different machine gun positions to defend it, and it was going to, they proposed that it could go out into the ocean and find enemy ships, and it would protect America from invasion. And for those with that talk and with these guns, one of the great statements here from one of our newspaper newsmen here in Seattle, Richard Smith, with the Seattle Times, he exclaimed on seeing this airplane that it was a flying fortress.
Yeah, so Boeing immediately trademarked that name, of course, and later Dick Smith went to work for Boeing PR department. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
So the plane flies around Seattle throughout August. Then it heads to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio for trials to compete against these clearly inferior twin-engine bombers from Douglas and Martin. They were kind of building old-school planes. Boeing kind of took it a notch ahead. The tests went on throughout September and October, and the B-17 is clearly outperforming the other two planes. So then on the morning of October 30th, 1935, 83 years ago yesterday, a crew of five is aboard the Model 299 for another test flight. They point the plane down the runway, accelerate, and head up into the sky, but they forgot to release a device called a gust lock.
As the plane was climbing without any control, it stalled, it crashed, and burned. The airplane was gone. And sadly, Boeing lost this wonderful test pilot, Les Tower, along with the Air Corps pilot. So this was an incredible tragedy. And not just the loss of a Boeing employee or test pilot, but the loss of this airplane. Everything the company had went into this prototype, and there it was, a burning wreck on the field. By default, Boeing lost the competition. We didn't have an airplane to finish, and Douglas won. So that was the end of the Boeing company.
Wow.
So the gust lock, when the plane is parked, the gust lock was put in place so the flaps didn't blow in the wind and get damaged, right? But it wasn't clear that that was turned on, and they didn't have checklists yet to go through.
So they couldn't move the flaps?
They couldn't change the altitude of the plane. It was set in such a way that they didn't realize it until, anyway, Les Tower ran up the central aisle to try to get them to turn the thing on. Anyway, very tragic plane. Les Tower died, this other Army pilot died. Mike Lombardi says things were pretty bleak around the Boeing factory in November and December of 35 as it looked like it would all shut down. But, of course, as we all know, it wasn't really over for the scrappy little aerospace giant. Come January 17th, 1936, things were looking up.
One thing saved it, and that was that taking that risk on being innovative, on taking that risk to go a little bit farther than what the customer asked for and give them a better airplane. This airplane flew faster, higher, could carry more, could go farther than the Douglas airplane. Clearly a better airplane all the way around. It was the clear winner if it had made it through the competition. And so the Air Corps decided they had to have that Boeing airplane.
The better product finally won out.
Yeah, they did buy something like a couple hundred of these Douglas B-18s, which are an old-school style of bomber, yeah. But then they found a way to pay for 13 Flying Fortresses that saved the Boeing company, and then the thing ultimately outperformed the other planes and was the workhorse of the war in Europe. And the whole notion of a pilot checklist came about because of what happened with these controls that were left locked in place. So just a weird little forgotten wrinkle in Boeing history before that famous plane took to the air.
Historian Felix Spinell every Wednesday on Seattle's Morning News. Thanks, Felix. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, and here's Hannah Scott. When Hannah Scott opens the door, you know that politics can't be far away because she's been following all these races, including the legislative races that don't get much coverage. And this time we have a Senate seat that state Democrats are hoping to flip.
Yep, there's a few of those, but this one is the 47th District that covers parts of South King County. That includes parts of Kent, Covington, and Auburn. It is one of the state's few swing districts with one Republican and one Democrat in the two House seats and moderate Republican Senator Joe Fain somewhere in the middle. The two-term senator is facing Democratic challenger and progressive Mona Das, a small mortgage business owner who was born in India and moved here with her parents as a child. In the primary, Fain came out ahead by about 7 points and had four times as much in campaign donations as Das. But then a bombshell allegation from a Seattle woman who claims Fain raped her in 2007 in Washington, D.C. after she went to his hotel room following a night of drinking. At the time, Fain issued statements to the Seattle Times denying the allegations and calling for a full investigation. But there's been really no movement on that and at this point. He also urged everyone to be respectful of everyone involved, including his accuser. Fain has been pretty silent since then, both about the allegation and about his reelection bid, not doing much in the way of campaigning or even showing up at candidate forums to face off with Das. Das isn't focusing on the allegations against her opponent, though, in the campaign, and would only say this.
I am a survivor myself, and I believe that we should believe women when they come forward.
Now, Fain declined multiple requests from me to talk about the issues during this for this story. So on his campaign website, I'll do my best to keep it fair. He describes himself as a nonpartisan problem solver who brings lawmakers on both sides together to come up with solutions for communities, something he did as he helped to get a paid family leave bill passed in Olympia. As for Das, her priorities include boosting the stock of affordable housing in her district for first-time homebuyers and coming up with creative ways to get more affordable housing for renters, such as ADUs. She says preventing homelessness is also a priority. As far as specifics,
renters' rights are something that we can start to look at. Folks, if they're 20 days late on their rent, might start the eviction process, so we can talk about eviction protection and eviction prevention. That is usually how people start to experience homelessness first, is they're late on their rent and then they can't afford to stay. And then they end up living in their cars, and then it goes, you know, downward from there.
And she says for transportation improvements in her district, she wants to see more park and rides and an ultimate goal of getting people out of their cars and into public transit. Das supports passing some type of car tab relief as well.
We need to make car tabs fair. We also need to, you know, we promised Sound Transit. We need to make sure that Sound Transit has their money. So we have to look for other additional sources for that because we need to deliver those projects on time and on budget.
Fain voted for a compromise bill on car tab relief last session that cleared in the Senate that would have saved drivers about $30 on their tabs. That bill is expected to come back up in the next session. Fain has also been a leader on education policy, and he helped get the McCleary education fix done. But Das is critical of his yes vote there because she says it didn't do enough for special education, which is something she would fight to correct should she win. Das also supports a capital gains tax, which will be pitched as a way to pay for education funding this session rather than the property tax that is funding it now. Fain says that's unconstitutional. Das supports I-1639, the gun control initiative that will be on the ballot, but Fain also supports responsible gun measures, securing a rare endorsement for a Republican, for him, from the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, which is backing I-1639 on the ballot. And while Fain gets a lot of praise for working the middle and bringing both sides of the aisle together to get things done, Das says she will offer the same.
Give and take is a part of life. It is a part of my business. I mean, I have to negotiate with realtors and underwriters and our staff to make sure that we get loans done. And we want to bring that type of excitement and collaboration to Olympia. We are not going to get anything done if we stop listening to each other. And I think that's what's been happening.
And for DOS, this is also about bringing more diversity to our state capital as well.
The top six seats that are flippable in the state this year are all women, which I'm very incredibly proud to be part of that. And also we're seeing lots of women of color running for the first time and people of color and communities of color to be representative. And I'm really excited about all of these things.
So it's not like you have two moderates running in this race.
Well, she's a progressive. She is. But
right.
Yeah, but they will work across the aisle is the idea.
She's not like a sign-carrying demonstrator chanting progressive.
No. I don't think so.
So, but she does. The big difference. Now, tell me about this. She, too, on the Democratic side, says she supports a capital gain tax. Is that what you're seeing among most of the Democrats you're talking
to? Yeah, I can't think of any that I've interviewed that have been against it so far.
So is it fair to say that is going to be a priority in the
I think it's definitely going to come up. You know, the state school superintendent is asking for it. That's his legislative ask. So it's going to be something I think that will come up again. And then it came up last year as well.
Right. But the jury is still out as to whether
it's constitutional.
Constitutional, correct?
Because
so far all the opinions are saying that you really can't differentiate between capital gains and the ordinary income that you're not allowed to tax progressively in Washington State.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to be an issue as well. But it's definitely going to come up, I can tell you that, and it's definitely an issue, a campaign issue for most in this election.
Have we collected all your stories in a convenient place somewhere where people can read them if they don't get to hear you?
They will be. They're coming up as I do them at mynorthwest.com, and you can get them there anytime.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Kyra's Hannah Scott. Time for a Sports Insider. Brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from that overstocked candy store of sports, 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. Edgar Martinez is going to stay with the Mariners, but his role will be different. I'm not sure I understand this change. He was the batting coach, right?
Hitting coach with the Major League team. Traveled everywhere. Worked with them before the game. Worked with the hitters. Was in the dugout for every game.
And now he is the organizational hitting advisor.
That's correct, which means he will have assignments. He'll go from here to there, wherever his schedule allows, and we'll see exactly how much he does or doesn't do. It's a much more vague position.
I see.
Which would be there.
Is this truly because he wants to spend more time with his family,
yes,
or do you think he was not being effective as the hitting coach?
No, it's because he wants a change in his schedule,
right,
and wants
intentions
to be more around. Yeah, this is the major league hitting instructor is essentially, they should put it in there as the sacrificial lamb.
Aww.
Because honestly, like, that's what the job primarily is. Hitting coaches don't really matter at the major leagues.
Oh.
Like, they really don't. Like, you can help a guy, but the amount of influence you have, you're dealing with already formed habits,
I see,
tendencies, everything that's there. A minor league hitting instructor or a roving instructor, he probably will be able to have a larger footprint in the organization and in the franchise in the role he'll be moving into than the one he was in.
But it sounds like pitchers can make adjustments, but hitters don't really?
They do. Pitching coaches, there's much more in the actual mechanism of their delivery in terms of taxing their arm. Mm. Even then, I think pitching coaches at the major league level, how we look at them conventionally, they're also overrated in their impact. Mm. When a guy gets to the major leagues, you're not teaching him to play the sport anymore. You're helping him correct habits. Mm-hmm. You're helping him identify holes and swings. But especially with a hitter, these guys change their swings all the time. Most of them have personal swing coaches. The idea that a major league hitting coach, basically they exist to be fired when a team struggles to hit the ball, and you're like, oh, we're just going to make a change, and well, we're going to fire the hitting coach. It's a largely irrelevant position.
Well, they let the pitching coach go too.
Yes, Mel Stottlemyre. I'm also not sweating that one either.
Yeah, so is this Riga? I mean, this was the best chance season, right?
Yes, this past year.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now it's what?
Well, they're going to try to restock. I want them to blow it up, Dave. Yeah. I want them to take everything that has value at the major league level and trade it. I want them to say, we're going to be terrible for 2 years by design, with the idea that we can contend in 3 or 4 years.
So the Houston Astros bought it.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I want them to strip it down to the studs. I want them to rip everything out, sell all the fixtures, kind of like at Bonneville here, where we've got the garden of abandoned toilets downstairs.
We're remodeling it.
And absolutely. I want them to do that to the Mariners. I want them to take all their toilets out. And I want them to pile them underneath the stairway and say, whoever wants one, whatever you'll give us, we'll take it.
Oh, you guys are great with those sports metaphors. So Nelson Cruz.
That was literally true. It wasn't a metaphor.
So yeah, there is
literally a pile of toilets in the basement of our building.
Why I don't
right
go
now.
Down there. Why are you going down there? There's no sports business down there.
I took a very artsy photo with an artificial plant in the foreground to make it look like it was a forbidden garden.
Yeah. So Nelson Cruz, free agent, he's not going to stick around?
I'll be interested to see. If they want to contend, he is. If they're going to...
Well, but if they strip it down to the studs, then...
Then he will not be.
That's some part of the drywall that has to go.
That's correct. That would be one of the... And he's not even installed right now because he would probably be on the move anyway. So we'll see if they do anything. Nelson Cruz will be a tell. If they don't resign Nelson Cruz, it's a sign that they are looking at it and saying, we're probably not going to get to the playoffs this next year, and we are positioning ourselves for 2020, 2021, really 2022, 2023.
And for the Seahawks, they let Brandon Marshall go.
Yeah, he wasn't doing much.
No?
He played two snaps. He's caught three passes, I think, over the past three games. Hasn't played much. Wasn't doing anything. Yeah. So you're going to let him go?
It's sort of a ho-hum, who cares?
Yeah. If a wide receiver falls in the forest and he hasn't caught a pass in a couple weeks, does anyone hear it?
What happens to him?
He'll try to find another job. Yeah. If not, he's going to go on television and probably make more money than he currently does as a football player because he's a great broadcaster.
Oh, is he?
Yes, he is. He's very, very good.
I haven't heard him.
He's on a Showtime show called Inside the NFL.
Uh-huh.
He's excellent. He's a very, very good.
Oh, good for him.
Very good interview.
Excellent. All right. So another rebuilding season for the... Actually, though, I kind of prefer that narrative rather than getting your hopes up only to have them dashed repeatedly.
Yeah.
Now
it's better not to have hope.
Scrappy group of kids who are, by golly, going to play out back of the barn. And if they win a game...
If I'm hoping they're good in 2023, they can't disappoint me in 2019.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be there. Also, Michael Kendricks got suspended 8 games.
Oh, for the insider trading.
Yeah, you guys could be my well, I don't care about insider trading. I wish that he would play in the interim until he goes to jail. He's been suspended for 2 more games than someone who's convicted of domestic abuse, though.
Huh.
Well, we go live to the White House, and CBS White House correspondent and admitted candy corn lover, Stephen Portnoy. The president is off to Florida, so you're there all by yourself eating your candy corn. Sounds very sad.
Yeah, we have him with us for the most of the early afternoon here in Washington, D.C., but then the president will head to Florida tonight. He's going to kick off several days of rallies in 8 states, 11 different rallies, so he's going to stop twice in Florida between now and the election, twice in Missouri, and twice in Indiana. And those are states where Republicans are hoping to defeat incumbent Senate Democrats and expand their majority in the Senate. And of course, the president's aiming to help Republicans hold on to the House as well. So the president is focused on the campaign. He's been tweeting about immigration and this whole issue of birthright citizenship. And most political analysts believe that the whole discussion about this week is meant to excite and energize the president's base.
Yeah. So is there any actual process going on to change the 14th Amendment? I mean, how do we know whether it's serious or not?
Well, it's a good question. You know, this came up yesterday morning in an interview in a new show on HBO that Axios, the online journalistic startup, is working on. And Jonathan Swan is the reporter who interviewed the president, and he actually popped the question, seemed to take the president by surprise that this reporter, who is one of Washington's better-sourced reporters, brought up the issue. And the president confirmed that he has been working with the White House counsel on this. Now, there's a new White House counsel who's just recently been installed and is in the process of taking on the job in a full-time capacity after all the forms are filled out and approved. Long story short, the former White House counsel, Don McGahn, is gone. So now you have a new incoming White House counsel. So the old White House counsel, Don McGahn, famously, it was reported, had clashes and confrontations with the president when the president wanted to do certain things. The president says he's now talking, I suppose, with his new White House counsel about doing this, which is issuing some kind of executive order that would in some way reinterpret the 14th Amendment. Now, what shape that would take, how soon might it come, we don't know. But the president tweeted this morning that he will end birthright citizenship one way or the other.
I see. So, okay, this reflects, and this is one of the reasons you change White House counsels, because the old guy was apparently trying to stop him from doing this kind of stuff. Well, that'll be pretty exciting then. So the strategy, when going to all these rallies, he's trying to pull the same kind of upset he did in 2016, it sounds like to me. He's looking at the map and he's saying, here's where we can win, And so if I can pull this off, wow, that really increases my power.
Here's where we can win, and here's how.
Yeah.
The themes, perhaps by going places that the mainstream press is and Democrats are not keenly focused on. Obviously, we'll see. One thing that's not tested, which by this time next week we will probably have a pretty good sense of it, is the extent to which the enthusiasm and that you see expressed in public opinion polls manifests at the ballot box. And this is the first opportunity for the entire country to speak with its collective voice at the ballot box since the president's election 2 years ago. And you're going to hear a lot of punditry, a lot of people, you have heard a lot of punditry, a lot of people saying one way or the other how things are going to go. The truth is nobody knows, because that's how close things are perceived to be based on the pre-election polling. By this time next week, we'll have a much clearer picture.
Yeah. What do you know about this report that somebody was trying to pay women to claim, make false allegations of harassment against Robert Mueller?
This is a very strange story that surfaced in a, I guess, mainstream way in a statement issued yesterday on the record from the special counsel's spokesman. Peter Carr is his name, and he sent out a news release, essentially a very short release, advising reporters that the special counsel's office has asked the FBI to investigate an alleged smear campaign against Robert Mueller. Now, this seems to center around allegations of sexual assault against Robert Mueller, which a self-described conservative lobbyist here in D.C. says he intends to unveil at a news conference tomorrow morning. The lobbyist's name is Jack Berkman, and he has been known to dabble in conspiracy theories, specifically regarding the late DNC staffer Seth Rich, who was murdered here in Washington, D.C. 2 years ago. Jack Berkman has claimed that he has whistleblowers inside the FBI who knows things. He says he was attacked earlier this year as a result of all this. Anyway, he's dabbled in this theory, and he put out a release in May of this year offering a reward to anyone with evidence of bias or wrongdoing against Robert Mueller. So Mueller's office says that it has heard from journalists that women have been offered money to make false claims. Berkman, the lobbyist, is insisting that the woman who is apparently going to make this allegation tomorrow has not been paid, or the allegations that he paid a particular woman are false. There's a lot we don't know here, and I'll be honest with you, Dave, reporters are being trepidatious about this because Essentially the allegation is one of sexual assault. We don't even know what the allegation is.
Yeah. All right. Stay tuned. Stephen Portnoy from the White House. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. PBS's Frontline is taking on Facebook in a special called The Facebook Dilemma. Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Dana Priest worked on this story. And from what I've seen, Dana, this goes over how Facebook decided that to make enough money to satisfy investors, despite all their promises of privacy, they had to exploit data collection. So did they lie to people?
Well, they didn't explain what they were doing, that's for sure. So you'll have to decide whether that's a lie or not. But you got it right. You know, when they decided to make a lot of money, they had to do several things, one of which you just mentioned. But the other was that they decided to use their algorithms to get you to stay on the platform as long as they possibly could, using, you know, psychological knowledge that they have of people. And what they found is people like to stay on and read things that make them emotional, whether that's good or bad, angry, sad, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they started feeding you through their news feed things that were not news, but were inflammatory or happy or angry or something like that. And they found that people would stay on longer so they could watch more ads, which the advertisers liked. And so really, the problems that they created that we see in the world, and not just in the United States, is we see that their problems are actually the byproduct of their business model. It's not some aberration that happens to them, but it's actually, you know, what their business model does in order to make them money. I'm sure they didn't set out to do these bad things or to make these things bad, but that is exactly what happens when bad actors come on and when they don't make any choices about what is in your news feed, what is actually news.
So this sophisticated targeting began not necessarily as a way to alter your voting behavior, but to get you addicted to Facebook itself.
Exactly. Not only the things that you found psychologically enthralling, but also what color shoes you want to buy. And so the advertisers could target somebody who wanted to buy red shoes versus blue shoes. They wouldn't have to waste their money on the people that wanted blue shoes. They already knew so much right. about you and what you'd already bought. But then they could use that same micro-targeting ability to then get into the manipulation of political thoughts or feelings. They actually had a big campaign to teach elected officials, to teach campaigns all throughout the world how to use their platform to reach out to voters or constituents. And the Trump campaign said, well, we will, you know, we're going to spend so much money on your platform. Why don't you come and tell us how to use it? And mm-hmm. Clinton campaign said, no, thanks. We got this. And so that's where you got the Trump campaign being able to use the tools that Facebook had created for other reasons to use them really to micro-target certain messages at certain people in certain districts who they really wanted to sway.
Okay. Is there something wrong with that? I mean, I see where it was perhaps accidental, but then, you know, Post-it notes were accidental and they became a big hit. So the problem was Hillary didn't have the same kind of vision that the Trump campaign did.
Exactly. It's not necessarily wrong that they helped the Trump campaign. What is wrong often about the political messaging is that it's not clear that that's what it is. And I'm not saying that the Trump people did this, but in general, in the political persuasion business, you have a lot of people like, let's say, the Russian government that uses the same tools, but you don't know that that's who's doing it. And you don't know if you go, like, say, on a pro-gun site versus an anti-gun site that you're being manipulated by someone. You can't see who they are. You can't see what their agenda is. And then you have fake accounts, bots coming on to talk with you, to join a conversation. And again, there's no transparency to know that that's what's happening to you. So you've given them so much data, you're ripe for manipulation, and they are taking that and trying to manipulate you in all different ways, from buying product to being angry about immigrants to any brand you choose can use this platform without telling you exactly who they are to try to make you feel one way or the other.
Yeah. Now, on the Frontline piece, you point out that Facebook can track you even if you're off Facebook. Are they still doing that?
To the best of our knowledge, they're still buying data from certain companies that allow them to do that. We don't think they completely dropped that practice, but they can, for instance, get data on, the stores that you enter, where you go, geolocation data, so they can track you physically, and you don't necessarily know that that's what they're doing. But even on the web, you know, I think a lot of people are surprised that they don't just track you when you're on Facebook, but they track you when you're on any website that has embedded in it something called a pixel, which is a little code that tells Facebook, oh, it's Dana Priest. She's on our website. Doesn't need to click on anything, just needs to be on the website, and they will be fed that information so that it will go into your profile basket and they can use that for their advertisers.
And I'm noticing that more and more websites now are telling you, if you want to continue reading this story, turn off your ad blocker. And when you do that, in Firefox, for example, there are various things you can turn on or off, and one of them is tracking. I found out that unless you turn off anything that prohibits tracking, you won't be able to see the article. So, I mean, it doesn't look like all this talk about privacy protection really amounts to a hill of beans anymore, if you want to use the internet, that is.
That's right. And we have this great segment where we talk about this young college student in Europe who figures this out and then asks the European regulator for his data. And he gets back thousands of pages. And it's really astonishing. Now it's something you can do yourself by going to the right side of the Facebook page to settings, click on settings, go down to request my profile, click on that, and you should get your profile. A lot of what Facebook collects about you and who else has it. And it's very surprising. I teach at the University of Maryland. I had my students do this, and they came back with some wild things, not only deleted accounts, but associations that they had with other people just because they both RSVP'd to a certain event. And they had closed Facebook pages. They had the names of other people that were on accounts that they thought were not going to be tracked by Facebook. So there was some big surprises, and I recommend that anybody do that. It's very easy to do.
Well, that's a good idea. That means you no longer have to spend your college years searching for your identity because Facebook already has it. Dana Priest, Washington Post reporter, on the Facebook dilemma from PBS's Frontline. Dana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.